Howie Politics and State Affairs Pro offer insider election coverage, polling, and analysis in Indiana. Our nonpartisan news and legislative tools create a winning combination pro subscribers can't live without. For all the resources you need this election season and beyond, visit pro.stateaffairs.com/IN. That's pro.stateaffairs.com/IN.
We're driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search. Match. With Indeed. Leveraging over 140 million qualifications and preferences every day, Indeed's matching engine is constantly learning from your preferences. So the more you use Indeed, the better it gets. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/match. Just go to Indeed.com/match right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Indeed.com/match. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is In the Loop with Jack Blake, an Indy 11 podcast. We bring you an insight into the lives of professional athletes with an emphasis on the mental side of sports.
Welcome to episode 2 of In the Loop. Thank you very much for listening to episode 1 if you have. If you haven't, go check it out with Aidan Quinn. Episode 2, we have two for the price of one today. Two very good friends of mine, two very good footballers, two very good teammates. The first coming out of Montevideo, Uruguay, Mr. Sebastian Guinzatti.
Oh, thank you, Jacko, for having me.
Thank you, mate.
Pleasure.
And the second heavy hitter we have today is Yunus Bedadi, coming out of Ypres, Belgium.
Ypres. Thanks, mate. Yeah, it's nice to know that we're, you know, important enough to come on your podcast. So it's an honor, mate.
Of course, mate. Of course. Thanks for coming on today. We're going to get into a lot of stuff to do with football. A lot of stuff to do off the field as well. Obviously, specifically focusing on the mental side of the game and how some topics that don't usually get talked about, sometimes overlooked. Let's get right into it. So I'm going to ask you, Mr. Bedadi, to start with. Talk to us about your journey in a brief synopsis from Belgium and then how you find yourself sat here at this table in Carmel, Indiana.
Yeah, I've kind of been all over. And not in the beginning part of my career. I started in a local club. I was around 4 years old. Stayed there for like 2 years. And then Club Brugge, which is an academy in Belgium, picked me up when I was seven. And then I kind of just stayed at the same place for 13 years. So I stayed from the under-8 academy team up until the under-21s. And that's when the U.S. came on my path and the opportunity to keep playing soccer, which was obviously my passion, but also get a degree. So I kind of just took that, went with it, and that was pretty quick. I think it came on my path around February, March, and I was committed to go to Boston College early in the summer. And then from Boston College, I was there for 2 years, had an opportunity to go to Creighton University, where I thought that it was a better pathway for me to get into the professional ranks in the U.S. So I graduated from Creighton, got drafted to LAFC, but ended up signing with Reno. The club folded down, I'm sure you can remember, a couple of years ago. So that was in 2020. So that's my rookie year, and then Reno folds after that season. So I end up in Hartford Athletic for 2 seasons, and now we're at my second year here in Indy.
So. Wow, fantastic. One of the reasons I wanted to bring you on was because I feel like we have a lot of similarities in the sense of coming from a European team, working our way through an academy, and then find ourselves in the States. How was your academy experience, the 13 years you spent at Bruges? Obviously, top club. They have a top history. How would you describe your academy experience as an overall?
Yeah, I think you kind of go through different stages. In the beginning, it's more of, you don't really know what you get thrown into when you're very young and you're 8 and you're just playing with your friends. So I'd say from your age 8 until 15, it's more about development and you're just having fun with friends, really. But I think there's a big shift around the age of 16, and then you get really thrown into the serious side of the academy, which is trying to prepare you for a professional team. And those years were more intense, I would say, from 16 to 20, from up until I left to the US. there was a big shift from, okay, this is kind of fun playing in this academy, but then there's a step as like, okay, they're trying to prepare you for the professional game. So I think those last 4 years were a lot more intense in a way, because they try to, like you mentioned, the mental aspect, and that aspect they really try to get into you, you know, trying to prepare you to play with men, because at the end of the day you're just playing with kids. So yeah, I think there was a shift in the beginning from what was fun, and obviously you're proud that you can play for a top academy, but then at the end it's more, you know, you start seeing that the professional side of the game that they try to implement in the academy.
So you think that, right, 16 years of age was probably the age where you were like, I think I could give this a good go, and you felt like you were being pushed by the club. How were your family reacting to that when you were 16 years of age, making that decision? Was there a moment where you were like, you know, mom, dad, like, I'm going to give this a real good shot, or did it kind of just organically grow?
Well, for me, there was kind of the youth national team path came on my way around that age. So up until then, I didn't really have, I always had the goal to become a professional player, but that opportunity came on my way around 16 years old, where I was called up to the youth national teams in Morocco. And for me, that was kind of a moment where it switched in my head. I was like, okay, this can become a reality in a way. And it was not really that far thought dream. So that was kind of what kickstarted the thought of, okay, I can, you know, push myself maybe into the first team here. But like you said, the mental aspect of the game, then it comes in. Like, you go to the youth national teams, I come back, and I don't think I had the patience or the understanding that things take time. And I was expecting things to go a little bit quicker. And then, you know, everyone has their own way. I came to the US. But definitely the mental aspect of the game is, I think, what kind of prevented me to push to that next level when I was still in Europe.
Well, covering all continents here with the Morocco, now talking about South America, I'm going to bring you in, mate. How was your journey? 12 years of age, you landed in Queens?
So, yeah, I got to Queens when I was 11. Obviously, Uruguay was going through a tough time, so my family decided to move out. Got into Queens, got to know an academy, Met Oval Academy, which they were my home for 12 years. My whole academy, I did in Met Oval. It was the first number that we called that we saw in the newspaper. I remember my mom calling, so it was a great call by her. And from there, you know, it was working in the academy. Obviously, it's not like now where you have, you know, MLS academies. Back then, it was just pretty much youth academies. And then you went to college, or, you know, you went to whatever you had next. And after that, when I was 17, actually playing in a park, somebody saw me, talked to my parents, told them that, you know, that I was a good player. He wanted me to take me to Uruguay and make me try out. And my family, you know, they talked to me. They said, you know, the next move is whatever you want, you know, go chase your dreams or stay, obviously, in Queens, go to school. And I decided to make that jump. I went back to Uruguay, tried out in the top team, Peñarol, in the youth. I was there for 2 years until the reserves, that's what it's called, the youth. When you get to a point, you play in the reserves and then at the pro level. Mm-hmm. After that, I was in the youth in Peñarol. So I didn't really have a chance. They were bringing really big names. At that time, they got to the final of Libertadores, which is the top competition in South America. So I decided to just move on to another team. I landed in a second division team in Uruguay, where I got my playing time. I was there 6 months until I got the call from Cosmos in New York. From there, I went to New York Cosmos. I knew Gio Savarez. He was the coach there. He had me in the academy as well. Mm-hmm. And yeah, from there, I played 5 years in the Cosmos, then moved out to the Rowdies for another 5 years. And now I'm here in the Indy. I'm going into my second year, like my guy here, Eunice.
What a journey. So, two crucial ages really for you, 11 and then 17. So I'm sure there's a lot of listeners that can resonate with that. Maybe they're at 17, 18, they haven't quite had an opportunity yet. And then you say that came from you playing in a park,
yeah,
and a scout,
yeah,
and then they took, yeah, you back over to Uruguay.
Yeah. You never know who's watching. You know, I always gave it all in every training, every practice, and I happened to be there at that moment. And, you know, it gave me a chance and I took it.
So, diving into, again, a bit more about the academy stuff. For me, there's some drastic cultural differences between an academy in Europe and an academy in America. I would say I first experienced the academy environment when I was at Salt Lake, Real Salt Lake organization, playing for the Monarchs. And we would get a lot of the academy lads come up. And I don't know, something just didn't particularly sit right with me in that, in the sense of, I felt like a lot of the kids in America, they get it handed to them easily. You know, whether it was game time, whether it was equipment, whatever it may be. I remember being at Forest at the age of 16, and I'm waking up, reporting to the stadium at 7 a.m. I'm cleaning the first team's boots before the training session. I'm cleaning their first team boots after training session. I'm carrying all the equipment down to the training field. I feel like, do you feel like there's a big difference between America and Europe in the mentality sense of coming through the academy?
I would say so. You know, at Bruges, there's times where I trained with the first team, but it wasn't like, it was, now I would say they're doing a better job with getting players to the first team, and I think there's a better transition, but I do feel like in the past, it was more of, you get thrown into the first team and you got to deal with all the shit that happens, you know, and you kind of got to earn your stripes over time. And I feel like, I don't know if it's a US thing, I've been here now for 8 years, so I haven't had the chance to go back and, you know, really observe the difference. But I agree with you in that, you know, there's a little bit different of understanding of what first team football means and what things that you have to do or what things that you have to change to be able to play consistently at that level. And I think when we were younger, I think there was a little bit more of understanding of those differences and that gap that there still is. And that there's a lot of hard work that goes into getting to that level. And where you say it's a little bit handed. I agree, and maybe there's a flip side to that, that maybe there's more opportunities given, but that there's not really looked at the things that still have to improve, enabled for that player to consistently play at that level.
Yeah, I think here actually we've got a real good bunch of academy lads, and I think they understand, you know, kind of the roles, responsibilities among the club, you know, treating people with respect and things like that. I think that's done very, very well here. I just think sometimes I feel like we had it a lot more difficult back then.
Maybe we're just nice lads, mate.
I feel like it was a lot harder.
I'd feel bad if I sent the kids to clean my boots after every training.
Oh, honestly, there were some mornings where if I messed up cleaning the boots, like say for example, I got them a bit too wet, and then the first team player got the boots out of the bag and saw and knew that I was the one cleaning them. Uh-huh. I'd be chased around the car park after training. Seriously. I remember the only time that we really got compensated for our hard work cleaning the boots was at Christmas. We had our Christmas bonus. So you got assigned like two players for the first team squad. You clean their boots all year. And at Christmas, you get a bit of money. You'd have to sing and dance in front of the squad, but you'd take the money after.
So. You graduated as a cleaner of their boots.
Yeah. So obviously you've had a massive career, especially at the Rowdies, becoming the captain. How was leadership? I know your leadership is very strong. You lead by example. You work so hard every day. Was the leadership and the captain's armband something you had to really work on, or did it come natural? How did the captaincy come about with the Rowdies?
Yeah, I think it comes natural. You know, once you show your true face and you are who you are in the locker room, you know, everybody feeds onto that. And that's what I'm about, you know, having everybody together, you know, fighting for the same thing, because we're all here, you know, right now for Indy, and that's what we got to fight for. But yeah, it just came, you know, like you said, in the academies, you know, you work so hard, and me going into train with the first team, you know, they'll give you ripped socks, so you value that after, you know, you value that later on in your career, and that makes you work, you know, twice as hard, and that's what I try to show every day and every training session, every weekend that we step on the field, and even in the locker room, you know, just have a good vibe with everybody, get everybody together and just fight for one.
Yeah, I think as well, like football can be such a matter of opinion as well. Like I feel sometimes you go from club to club and coach to coach, even organization changes, you know, there's things that are out of your control. And so what advice would you give someone who's potentially listening to this that might be in a scenario where things aren't going well? Maybe the coach doesn't fancy them. Maybe they're not getting the game time they want. What would your advice be to those people?
No, just to keep working hard. You know, obviously, not everybody's perfect. You know, and everybody has to look at themselves and see what they could do better all the time. Because, like I said, you know, nobody's Messi or Ronaldo, so we all got to work 100% always. And yeah, obviously it comes from hard work. You know, you don't get just that Captain Ben out of nowhere, you know, wake up with it. No, it comes from a lot of hard work, and people see that. And yeah, that's.
So back to your Moroccan experience with the national team. If you could think back to that period of time, obviously when you got the call up, I'm sure you and your family are extremely proud. Yeah. How was that experience? Where was your first game? What countries did you visit?
Well, it happened very quick. We played a game in academy, and then after Pim Verbeek, he used to be the head of academy for the national team for Morocco, and he came over to watch two of our other players in our team actually. So our goalkeeper was from Morocco, and then we had a left back who was from Morocco as well. But I didn't have my Moroccan passport. I was born in Belgium, but we just never really looked after getting me my Moroccan citizenship. So at the time, I wasn't legally Moroccan. But that game, luckily, I had a really good game. And after the game, the two players that were Moroccan called me over, and they said, oh, there's a guy from the national team here, and he wants to see if you're Moroccan, because I had a Moroccan name, Yunus. So then I got called in, and they said, can you get your passport sorted as quick as possible. And there was a camp that they organized, I would say a week later or 2 weeks later, in Morocco, with around, I would say, 40 to 50 players just from European academy systems, where they went around Europe and they would get players from Italy, Spain, France, Holland, Belgium, and then put them together in a camp for 3-4 days. And that was basically then they were choosing around 15 players to go to the Africa Cup of Nations, who we hosted at the time. It was in Morocco. So I got my passport sorted really quick. Next week I was on a plane to Morocco for that camp, did well, and then ended up being selected for the eventual selection for the Africa Cup of Nations. That was maybe a month later. So all these things happened very quick. Then we did well in the Africa Cup of Nations. We went to the semifinal, got eliminated by Ivory Coast, but that gave us a chance to go to the Under-17 World Cup as well that year. So the Africa Cup of Nations was around March. And the World Cup was in November.
What year was that?
2013. It was in the Emirates.
Who won it that year?
Nigeria won it.
Nigeria won it? Really?
Yeah.
Because England won it the 4 years later, didn't they? Or is it every 2 years?
I think so. It's every... Now you're making me think. I would say 2 years. I don't think it's every four. It's every 2 years. Yeah, because, I mean, you'd have to get lucky to get thrown into the Under-17 pool if you're 13 years old. 4 years later, you're too old to play in it. So I think it's every 2 years, yeah.
Was there ever a period of time when you were back in Uruguay where you got a sniff of international stuff or at schoolboy level? Or?
No, I mean, just training with the first team, you know, there was a lot of big names at the time. You know, players that played in Italy that won Champions League. There was a forward as well. And those players make you realize, you know, how hard you have to work, because they're doing everything right next to you. And you're nobody at that time. So you look up to them, you're like, man, you know, I got a long way to be like these guys right next to me. So it makes you, you know, value everything you do, you know, from when you were a kid and, you know, you just do it for the love until, you know, you sign your first contract and you see what they're doing. They don't just do it for... They wake up and they really, you know, give everything for it. Mm. So that's why they had the careers.
The Peñarol under-19s, and then you went to, is it Huracán?
Huracán. Yeah, second division. Yeah.
Huracán. Please.
Yeah, so I was in Peñarol until I was 18, 19. And at that age in Uruguay, if you're not playing in the first team, you're already getting too old. So that's the big difference also in the U.S., you know, in Uruguay, when you're 20, you have to be playing first division. If not, you know, your time starts getting limited.
I remember you telling me as well that there's a lot of turnover in players and transfers. So, like, if you have a good few months in Uruguay, you're getting bought immediately to Europe or wherever.
Yeah. And that's in any team. It doesn't have to be in the top team. Uruguay has such a, you know, wide market. We sell a lot to Italy, Spain. The U.S. now took the market. You know, the MLS have been buying everybody from Uruguay. And, you know, they play maybe 6 months and they, you know, they leave and their teams have to restack again and build again. So, you know, it's a whole thing they got going on.
So can you paint the picture? Go back to when you were 10, just before you went to the US. Paint the picture for us what it's like, you know, on the streets of Uruguay. What would your day look like after school? I know you have the story about the uniform and getting the bus and stuff. So tell us a little bit about Uruguay, life in Uruguay as a 10-year-old.
Yeah, so in Uruguay, you go to school with the uniform and a big blue bow tie. So
producer here, we gotta find a picture.
Yeah. So I would leave school straight away, leave my backpack. Sometimes even get in back of the bus, you know, just hang on to the bus a few blocks, because you get in on the bus for free when you have the uniform. So I would go two blocks, lay my stuff down on the block, and play the whole day. And it was every day, all day. You know, the love for the game, it's always there, you know, in the streets. And, I mean, most of the top countries, that's where it comes from. You know, you learn from the youth is, you know, just play. Have fun and play with your friends. And then, obviously, it starts getting a little bit more serious. But it was every day, just play every day. My mom would have to call me over, for food, and I wouldn't go. She would have to bring it to the corner for me to eat.
That's why he's so skinny, lad.
Yeah. And my brother.
I bet he'd go if she called him over for mate. He's straight there.
So, yeah, my brothers always said it, you know, I was a street kid. I was in love with soccer my whole life. You know, I was chasing after a ball since I could remember. Since I joined the first team was at three.
Yeah.
So, you know, in Uruguay, it's part of life.
Yeah, so it's interesting because I feel like in the States, you don't particularly get the street side of the football. And obviously, you've millions of touches on the ball from the age of three on the streets. And then you kids in America potentially, you know, have a range of five, six different sports that they play at school. You know, nothing's just solely football. And so I think there's something to be said for the street environment and growing up on the streets with the ball. Obviously, not always. It's not always. Not sometimes it's dangerous. But what do you feel like? In Belgium, was there a lot of street football going on?
There was, but more in the bigger cities. So I grew up mostly in there's a lot of... It's not a big city. So like in the big cities like Brussels, Antwerp, Ghent, that's where a lot of the proper, you know, street footballers come out. And there's a lot of players that came from those streets. Like if you think about Dembele, Fellaini, Hazard. There's a lot of players that they make documentaries of. This is where they grew up. And it's mostly in the big cities where there's a lot of players that are mixed like me. Like a lot of half Moroccans, half Belgians or Turkish players. Mm-hmm. A lot of players from the Middle East, Africans, Congo. So there's a lot of talent that can be found there. But at the end of the day, I also think it's a funding thing, you know. I feel like in Europe, they spend so much money in the academies that it's possible for them to go out and look on the streets to find all these players. Whereas here, you know, soccer is still growing. And the foundation for a lot of the smaller academies is not there yet for them to just pump in the money and get all these players to come to them. And I think that's where the disconnect is a little bit in. Where players here have a pay-to-play system where it's not always possible for the parents to, you know, to showcase the talent of their kid, which is a shame. But, you know, it's just different parts of where the soccer is evaluated in the world, I guess. Or
yeah, I think my academy experience was the training was a lot. You know, from the age of eight to going professional at 17, we were training three or four times a week. And there's something peaceful about the academy environment. You know, there's not the intenseness of the parents. There's just pure football, pure kind of coaches. And so when you were in the national team at 16, 17, what would your typical training day look like in terms of...
In Bruges? Yeah, it's pretty intense at the time because what they do with players that hit the age of 12, 13, and that happened with me as well. I used to still go to my local school up until I was 12. My parents would drive me four times a week after training. It was an hour and a half drive, you know, so we'd get back late every day. So what they try to do then when they're 12, all the players that are not from the area around Bruges, they bring them in into one school. So we would have our school system connected with the academy. So we would go to school from... I would say 8 to 10, then we'd get picked up by a bus from the academy to go train. So then it would be more like a tactical, technical session, something to more, you know, help the development of the player instead of being at a hard session, I guess, just trying to develop all aspects of the game. Then we go back to school, or we would eat at the club, go back to school for another 2-3 hours, and then around 6 p.m. we would have our team session. So that was mostly 4 or 5 days a week. And then we would have our game on Saturday, and I would go home on Sunday. So I would be home one day a week on Sunday, and then Monday morning I would be off again to, you know, to the boarding school up until you're 16, or at least whenever you finish high school. Mm. So those days were pretty similar. It was 4 or 5 days a week. We would probably train twice a day for 3 out of the 5, and then have the game on the weekend, come home on Sunday and relax for a bit.
That's intense. So Seba, the experience in your first couple of games playing in America, I'll go after you. I want to hear what you say first. But what was your expectation coming from Uruguay, playing at the Cosmos? What was your expectation of the level, expectation of the players, and how you were going to do as opposed to the reality? Mm-hmm.
Well, in the Cosmos, we had a huge name, so the expectation was pretty big. Mm-hmm. You know, I came here, Senna was signed. You know, we had Roberto Ayose. We had Mendes. We had so many stars. So the expectations were really, really big when I came here. Obviously, you know, it's I think the environment is a little different, you know, going into the field. I think, you know, it's really crazy. And, you know, in Uruguay, in South America in general, Europe, you know, yeah, the environment is just they breathe soccer. So, you know, there's a lot of pressure to win every game, a lot of pressure to get out there and give it all. You know, as long as, in your way, it's the thing, as long as you give it all, fans are going to be happy. And I think that's a little bit of our culture. And you, if you see all the players around the world, Uruguayan players, all of them are going to give it all, because that's just how we grow up. You know, the love of soccer, it just makes us want to just give it all in the field.
Mm-hmm. And so, well, when I first came over, I landed at Minnesota when they were playing the NASL, so mm-hmm. it would have been the same league as yeah. the Cosmos. And honestly, I didn't really know what to expect. I kind of felt like, coming from England and coming from the academy structure there, I had a good pedigree, and I felt like I could do really well. I was really surprised at the level. I was surprised at the players. At the time, the NASL was a strong league in terms of mm-hmm. money and the finances behind that, so they were able to bring in these players like Raul and Senna and yeah. Guinzai. So I was really surprised, and I was talking about this on the last episode with Aiden about kind of you know, the expectation and what you think, because you, until you're immersed in it, until you're actually in the environment, whether you're watching the games live or you're playing, you don't really know, and you don't get that publicity back in Europe. You know, yeah. not many people are watching the USL back in England.
Yeah.
And so it can be difficult to also go back the other way. You can go back to Europe, unless you have a standout season, crazy season in the MLS. Mm-hmm. It can be difficult, and that's not because of ability. It's not because of anything else other than people aren't necessarily seeing, and their opinion at the time of the league might not be good. So, when you were growing up, who was your idol?
So, when I was young, obviously, I'm a Peñarol fan. So, at that time, you know, I was... All I knew was Peñarol. I had no idea about any other team in the world.
Yeah, you obviously still only watch that team. Every time we travel on the bus, he's got a Peñarol game on from 2010.
Yeah, very true. But, obviously it was the forward from Peñarol at that time. That was my idol. Then growing up, it was Ronaldinho. After, you know, when he became what he was after Ronaldinho. I think Ronaldinho was one of, you know, somebody I saw video all the time once I came to the U.S. and we had a
yeah,
computer. Yeah, but no, yeah, definitely Ronaldinho.
Yeah, looking back, I think I maybe should have looked a little bit more at the attacking players, would maybe score a little bit more goals. Believe it or not, I scored a lot of goals as a kid, but somewhere on that way, you know, just deteriorated a little bit. Yeah, dried up. But for me, I became a right back pretty early, so I was always in awe with what Dani Alves could do on the ball, and how explosive he is, and how he would defend against, you know, at the time, Ronaldo in his prime. That was just a battle that I would always look at, Dani Alves against Ronaldo. So that was kind of a player that I was always looking at when I was growing up, yeah.
Yeah, I remember watching the Champions League and Dani Alves and that Messi era.
Yeah.
I feel like Champions League back then was even higher quality than it is now, and some ridiculous goals every week in the Champions League. But like, when you go back and watch those games, we were blessed.
Yeah, yeah.
So, moving on to nicely into the career stats. Let's play a little game. Yunus, I want you to guess how many professional games Mr. Guenzatti has under his belt. And I don't know if Seba knows, but he's coming up on a huge milestone.
247.
Seb, you want to take a guess?
Could be more. Could be more.
Yeah, I would say 300, man.
299. Yeah. He acted as though he didn't know.
I'm getting close to 300.
Trying to think of the pictures. 150, 150.
Damn, 300. Right. That's huge.
So,
man.
299. How many goals does he have?
And I think in the league, it's around 75, something like that. 74, maybe. In the USL. NASL days, let me say, 112.
No,
in total?
No. Maybe 82?
87. Yeah, okay. Yeah. And how many assists? Bonus point. How many assists?
Wow. That's a tough one.
18.
15.
Hey, you're way more unselfish than you give yourself credit for. 31.
31. Wow.
31 assists.
Not unless, a selfish player. Then. No.
I did not know
unless
that.
Unless Transfer Market has it wrong. 31. Okay, let's flip it. How many professional appearances does Mr. Budadi have?
Budadi. Well, I know he just hit. So I would say 180.
Hey, I've only played professional in the US, so it's easy. I've always played in USL.
So you just hit the mark. Yeah, 100.
Yeah. 100. maybe a little more. Like
I have you down as 104.
Stuff. Yeah, with open cup and playoffs and stuff, yeah.
Do we want to skip the goals? Or
yeah, throw it in there.
How many professional goals?
Throw it in there, lad.
Zero. How many assists in 104? Assists are hard to come by the way.
Yeah, they
assists are.
Are
very hard to come by.
20?
No, I think it's 13, maybe 12.
I have you down as 8.
8?
8 assists. You, on Wikipedia, something comes
that's
up about...
Right,
it's not right?
But we'll stay with it.
All right. We'll come back and refilm this.
I'm just slugging. kicking me on the ground here. 0 goals.
Maybe you just could send in a selfie video for the episode.
Yeah.
Could correct us. Have you... On Wikipedia, it says you played in Boston Bolts and Laredo Heat. What was that?
Yeah, so what happened in college, I didn't know of that system either. You know, when I was thrown into college, they kind of told me the idea of that college players would go into USL League 2 or PDL. Boston Bolts at the time was PDL and Laredo Heat was NPSL. So in between my junior and senior year, and that's when the NPSL and PDL seasons are, then the summer. Mm-hmm. So a lot of college players, when this first semester was done, around, I would say, June, instead of going home, because our season would start in August and doing nothing for 2 months, a lot of players would go to a PDL team or NPSL team for 6 weeks or take your break and then go to play PDL for 6 weeks before starting the second semester, kind of getting legs going. Because preseason was only 2 weeks, so that was the two times that I played for those teams.
Yeah, one thing I've struggled with to adapt initially was how long the off seasons are in the States, like 3 to 4 months sometimes. And I guess the first couple of years I had it was kind of in the off season, not sure whether to rest for a little, whether to keep going, like what to do. Have you mastered your off season routine now? What do you do?
Yeah, for me it changed. When I came in the league 5 years ago, it was a little harder because off season is just, you're not used to a 3 month off season. Even though in college I kind of got used to having a longer break. A lot of players maybe came from Europe where they're used to a half season, a little break, another half season, and then a smaller summer break. So I kind of got caught in trying to get too fit too early in off season. And now when season is done, I kind of take a full break for 4 to 6 weeks. And I just, you know, take my time to really let my body recover and get rid of all the tightnesses and all the the bruising and bumps that comes with a season, especially in USL. It's a grind sometimes. But now I take my 4 to 6 weeks, and then I just go really hard for 6 weeks, and then try to peak towards, you know, the start of preseason.
Mm. What about you, Sabino?
I kind of always try to stay active, but I haven't mastered it yet, but still trying to figure it out. Yeah. But it's like, you know, some preseason I get better than others, you know, going into the season. But yeah, the first few weeks I tried just to, yeah, like Yunus said, you know, take my time to heal my body, and then little by little get going.
Mm. The other adaptation as well, which was difficult, was the travel for away games.
Yeah.
Like, nowhere else other than the States do you travel for your own league games as far as mm-hmm. we go. I guess, yeah, people may not realize listening to this, you know, our last away trip, we had an 8-hour bus the day before the game. We busted 8 hours immediately after the game. With the travel and stuff that we've had to adapt to, what do you think are the key one or two things you do whenever we travel to ensure that come game time you are flying?
Yeah, go ahead, sir. I don't know if you... Well, for me, it's if we had a long travel day, I try to get my legs going. Because, you know, in the beginning when you travel so much, you're not used to it, and I would feel a little heavy on game day. So whenever we have like a long trip, if we don't have training at the place that we're playing at, I try to get in the pool or in a jacuzzi or something to kind of just get my blood flowing and get the tightness out from the travel day. And I think sleep is really important, just trying to get a really good night of sleep in the day before the game. Hydration, you know, I think Seba is probably the most hydrated guy in the team at all times.
Shout out Elementi.
But yeah, I think hydration, a good sleep, and then getting your body going after a long travel day, for me, are the three things that can help me feel okay on a game day on the road.
What about you, mate?
Yeah, definitely hydration, I think, is one of the most important, you know. Sometimes you're training and then traveling, or traveling and then training where you are, so it gets tough. And like you said, you know, 8 hours on bus and all that, it's not easy at all.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I like to get my body moving as well, you know, stretching in the room, foam rolling. I get the Normatec as well. Anything that will help me prepare myself for the next day, I try to do it.
One thing I wanted to ask you about was, I think you mentioned it earlier, but the situation with Reno and how that ended up, the club folded, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. So how, you were there 2 years?
1 year.
1 year.
Yeah.
How did that, did you get a sniff early on in the season or mid season that might happen? How were you told? How did it all shake its way through?
Yeah, it was a very weird situation because we were good that year. We, you know, when we went into the playoffs, we were the first seed in USL, so there's not really anything that was ever said about the club folding, but it was the COVID year, and I knew that Reno at the time was only their fourth year, so they struggled financially. I think that year that they couldn't have any fans, and they used to play still in a baseball stadium, and there were talks at the time that Reno could not play in that baseball stadium anymore, and there was a lot of uncertainty about the 2021 season with COVID. Like, we weren't sure if it was going to be the same thing at the time. And I think they didn't want to take that risk financially. If they had another COVID year without fans, they would be, you know, financially not good enough to survive. So I think at that point, they just cut it off. And it was very sudden. We never heard anything about it. Season was done. We had our end of the year talks. They picked up my option for the next year. So I thought I was sorted. And then I would say a week or two later, we just got a message in a group chat that the club was folding because the news was leaked to a local, I think, news station. Mm. So they wanted to tell us before it came out. So like an hour later, it was all over media. But we got told an hour before, yeah, sorry guys, the club is folding, and that was kind of it. So
cheers, thanks for everything you've done. See you later.
It was pretty straightforward. You know, they told us, and at that point, everyone is a free agent. And you know, luckily, I was able to find a club pretty quickly. I think I signed with Hartford 2 weeks later, but. Mm.
Straight on the phone to the agent.
But you know, at the time, looking back at it, I was a rookie, and I think I only, you know, with the COVID year, it was a shortened season, so I only appeared in 7 games, and I came out of college, so there's definitely a little bit of uncertainty that I was thinking, okay, I had the confidence that I knew that I could contribute to other teams in the league, but I wasn't sure if I was able to, if I was able to showcase that in the 7 appearances that I had. So in that aspect, it was good that I found a club pretty quickly, and that the team did well that year. So a lot of players ended up finding teams, but you know, on the flip side of it, if a team struggles to do well during the season and they fold on a you know, on a season where they weren't great, I'm sure it's very hard for a lot of players to find a contract after that.
Yeah, I mean, you'll remember this with the NESL folded, but mm-hmm. the San Francisco Deltas were in the league 1 year. They won the whole league, and then just folded immediately. Yeah. Like, incredible. I was at Jacksonville, and played in 2017. At the end of the year, signed a new contract. I think it was 3 years. And then go back to England, land back in Jacksonville for the following season, sort out an apartment, everything for the next year, me and my missus, and get a phone call from the GM, say, hey, just a heads up, like, don't sign the lease on the apartment. Like, we don't know what's happening with the league. And I was like, what do you mean, what's happening with the league? And we couldn't even fathom, you know, coming from the European mindset of, yeah. Clubs have been around for years.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking too when our club folded. It was like, I didn't really understand what was said. Like, they kind of said in a group chat of, like, we ceased operations, and they kind of tried to explain the concept of a club folding, but I didn't really understand. No. It was like, so they just taken a season off, or no, I said, no, the club is done. And it's something that you don't really see back home, but I think it's also because it's been around for so long, so it's almost embedded in their culture. It's not even, I would say, an option and a community for a club to fold in that aspect. And, you know, clubs here started way later in the time base, so I don't think they've had the years and advantage to really create that community, that strong community, where it's not seen as a possibility anymore for the club to disappear, because there's so many, you know, from different angles, people that rely on the club in some way, even mm-hmm. if it's from a fan's perspective of, yeah. or... you know, from a player's perspective, because players move on to different clubs. But if the club was able to build such a strong community, mm-hmm. that it's almost not, you know, possible for mm-hmm. the club to fall anymore. It's I think that helps a lot in Europe, because the clubs have been around for so long.
Yeah, and also I think the promotion relegation helps, because
yeah.
that you have that infrastructure, and the fans have that joy of being able, or the, mm-hmm. the hope of being able to be promoted, or yeah. the
yep.
you know, the feeling of getting relegated. Lads, I'm thoroughly enjoying this. We've probably only got a couple of minutes left, though, so I'm going to wrap it up. Okay, I'm going to ask you both one question just to end with. Sabino, if you could go back to when you were 17, starting your professional career, what's one piece of advice you would give yourself back then, knowing what you know now about professional football?
Don't feel bad for yourself. I would, you know, there were so many opportunities that I wanted to throw the towel, but you know, it's just that fight in me that just, you know, do it for your family, for your wife, whatever you have, you know, that motivates you. And I think you know, it went a long way in my career. There was a, you know, a bunch of times that I could have threw the towel, but you just gotta, you know, stick to your dreams,
get right back up.
Yep.
For me, it would be to kind of embrace the moments that it's not good, to be able to get to the place that you want to get to. You know, I think it's a thing that a lot of young players struggle with, myself included, when I was at that age, that you think that, you know, you see these big talents break through, you know, in Champions League, young kids, 16, 17, 18, 19, and you think that's the pathway that all these young players go on. But a lot of the times, it takes a little longer than players actually think in their own head when their breakthrough is coming. So I think for me, it was the advice that I would give myself is just embrace the moments where it doesn't go well, because you have to go through them, at least if you're in the 99% players at a youth level, to get to the level that you want to get to.
Wow, two incredible answers. Thanks, chaps. Thank you very much for joining me today. Thoroughly enjoyed it. Hope you listeners have enjoyed it too. We'll see you on episode 3 next time if you're joining us.
This is In the Loop with Jack Blake, an Indy 11 podcast. Be sure to like and follow this podcast, and check out other great podcasts on the All Indiana Podcast Network. To watch the video of this podcast, subscribe to the Indy 11 YouTube channel.